just because somebody thinks it's a bad idea doesn't mean it's a bad idea. So I had lots of people tell me that Seedlip would never sell a bottle, but I held on to the bigger forces at work that told me that there could be an opportunity for a grown-up, sophisticated option if you're not drinking alcohol. And that's what I tried to stay fixed to, even though there were lots of haters, lots of naysayers, lots of people that, you know, told me, what's the point? And this is, you know, this is a terrible idea.
This week, we welcome Ben Branson, founder of Seedlip and Season. My goodness, Ben, he is just like this sort of entrepreneur, creative genius. I want to say he's in a lab coat, a white lab coat, but he wasn't. But that's sort of what you'll picture when you listen to the creative genius that created the first non-alcoholic drink that we now all know, that's sold across the globe, 35 countries no less, in 4 years. This is just one of those stories where you have to hold on and listen to where ideas can come from, how they are sometimes so hidden, they need to be searched for. And then once they're discovered, it's only those with bravery and slight madness that would take on the challenge. And then that is what we then all see as this overnight success. Seedlip is one of those businesses which is absolutely going to go down in history as an iconic story of when you find a gap in the market, you're brave enough to go for it, and it all pays off.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Ben, it's the day we get to chat. I know that I met you a few weeks ago and we had the best time. Ben, you are an entrepreneur, a visionary founder, a creative mind behind Seedlip, and I cannot wait to talk to you. Welcome to Conversations of Inspiration.
Well, the tables have turned now, Holly. So, yeah, I love talking to you the first time. And so, yeah, should make the second time even better.
Well, now the focus is on you because we're going to talk about your podcast at the end of this podcast and the fact that I was so lucky enough to be asked to be a guest. But we're going to sort of start this podcast with your story because you're called the founding father of the non-alcoholic category. I mean, I've got a few niche titles, Ben, but that's even more niche than my ones.
Do you know what? When someone in the US said to me, oh yeah, Ben, you're the OG, and I had absolutely no idea what OG kind of stood for.
What does OG stand for?
The original gangster.
Oh.
I love that I am now sharing that piece of information with you.
Oh,
by
my,
the way.
But yeah, I mean, we are quite yes, you are. There's lots of things like that that I have no idea. But I sort of sometimes feel that this is a family here on this podcast. So they expect me to just actually fess up the fact that, oh, she's lying. She doesn't know what OG means.
But it's like you're the OG. You're the OG of helping small businesses, Holly. So, yeah, you're an OG.
So you founded this world's first non-alcoholic spirit, and it's taken you from your literal kitchen, we're going to get into this story, to 35 countries, to the world's best bars, hotels, retailers, within this sort of crazy four-year period. Then Diageo, that tiny company, taking the majority stake and taking that business on into the world. And you've obviously got this podcast that I was on as well, The Hidden 20%, which we're going to talk about. But I cannot wait to get into your life because it has so many twists and turns. When you started Seedlip, you said it was because of your love of nature and the very roots and going back to your childhood and your family's heritage, because you grew up in North Lincolnshire with your mum and dad and your two younger brothers and a whole host of animals.
Yes.
Tell me about the memories of growing up in the country.
It's the same now as it was when I was a little boy, in the sense that I am absolutely happiest outside. And I've noticed that I want to spend all my time outside, and therefore, you know, weekends at home with the kids, I'm just engineering ways to be outside with them, regardless of the weather. We're out in the woods in the winter going, great, toast marshmallows, they're game. Means I get to go and be up in the woods and we get to go and build a little campfire and, you know, carve sticks. And
yeah.
That was me as a little boy. It was, you know, mum kind of in the school holidays, you know, out you go, out the door, off you go, make some fun, make some mischief, build dens, I just loved building things. That's something that I've absolutely carried with me, I think, just wanting to make and create and try stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting when you said that, because I like building things, and I thought to myself, gosh, I've never looked at my own childhood, that I was a young engineer of the year for my recycling bin. Obviously everyone knows
amazing.
This. I mean, it's huge news. Maybe there is this thing as of building, actual building, and then we go on to building companies. But there is this, I don't know, there's nothing more than I like building in spaces, or for you, dens and things like that. That's quite a, anyway, that's just hit me. Your dad was in the world of design, though. You had a design influence in your life from a young age. Was that something that you loved? Were you drawn to it?
Yeah, my dad would be in London during the week and then he'd come back to the countryside at weekends. And I was always fascinated to chat to him. What had he been doing? And that the one thing that my brothers and I were absolutely like amazed by was, Dad has a man with his head in a bucket in the corner of his office. This was the, it was a cutout. It was a cutout of a piece of advertising of a man with his head in a bucket. And that to us was absolutely amazing. And so it was kind of like, Dad, where have you been? What are you working on? And so being exposed to the world of sort of design and advertising and brands and London as this kind of incredible melting pot of, wow, a big city. I don't know, it felt like a really amazing combination. And then, I got suspended from school a few times in my teenage years, and my mother would not have me at home. You're not coming home. You are going to London, and which, to be honest, was not a punishment. You know, you're going to go and you're going to go and work for your father. And so then getting the opportunity to go and be in London at 13 and go and work in a design agency, I mean, it was absolutely not a punishment. Maybe that's why I kept getting suspended.
Tell me, everyone's now asking, what was the man in the bucket?
Yeah, I know.
Now you're like, actually, I can't remember. What's the brand?
I don't even think there was a brand. I think it just became this, and I never saw it. I never went to that office where Dad had a man with his head in the bucket. But it always, I don't know, it's something that I was probably only 5, 6, 7 at this point. That was the thing that you said about Dad. What does your dad do? He works in London, and in his office, he has a man with his head in a bucket.
Head in the bucket. Well, so you then got your mum sort of slightly passed the buck and got you to go to London and work for Dad. But then you also went off to boarding school at quite a young age. And I know that you, I was reading about you, found school okay at boarding school because you were pretty sporty and academic.
Yeah, it was a bit of a, I don't know, there was a bit of love-hate relationship with being at boarding school. Put it this way. My kids are 11, nearly 5 and 2. and I would not send them to boarding school at seven. My mum went to boarding school, her brother went to boarding school, her father went to boarding school, mum's side of the family, boarding school, that's what you did. My dad's side, you know, state school, did not go to boarding school. And so I hated it initially, and I hated the fact that I couldn't talk to my parents for 3-4 weeks, and I couldn't see my parents for the first 3-4 weeks for a seven-year-old, a little bit cruel. But then actually, I love routine and structure, and I welcomed, I guess, on reflection, the fact that I was kind of institutionalized till I was 18. I didn't hang out a lot with my family. You know, I saw my brothers obviously at school, but yeah, dad was always away working, school holidays, fine. But it's not a kind of normal, it's not a normal thing when you kind of go off at 7-8 years old and you're away from home for 4-5 weeks and then you're back for a weekend and then you're off again. But I love sport. I love being outside. So of course I love sport. And I was good at sport and I was clever and I'd very much learned social etiquette and manners had been very strongly instilled in me growing up. And so I could, I could get by, I could do small talk and I could get on and get by. But I ended up being pretty badly bullied for being good at sport. And that was sort of this weird belief that kind of left me with, I guess, of like, if I'm really good at something, people are going to not like that. I found that obviously quite tough.
I was talking to someone the other night at a dinner party and we were talking about boarding school. He had been sent to boarding school as well, at a similar age actually. And he just said what a profound effect it had on his life in a negative way. And so much so, he'd gone on this retreat for men who had gone to boarding school. And actually, I need to tell you about it offline, but he said it was the most cathartic thing he'd ever done, ever, because there is just a huge, anyway, it's a whole podcast, isn't it? I'm just going to put a pause there because that's a whole podcast. At the time, what you didn't know, and years later, you would find out is that you've been diagnosed with autism and ADHD. When you look back at that period of your life, and I'm wondering if that institutionalization helped you in a way. Did you see elements of that in your childhood that you can now pinpoint? And was having that routine, I'm wondering if that routine actually helped you, but you were unaware of why it was helping you.
Yeah, I think the 7-day a week routine, right, from boarding school was a big help, even wearing a uniform, right? I only now really wear black jumpers and green cargo trousers. But having that structure of, this is when you change your bed sheets and this is how you change your bed sheets and you're going to change them yourself. You're going to shine and polish your own shoes. And there's a routine and a ritual to that. All of these little, you know, here's where you eat, here's what time you do this, I welcomed and were really good for me. Socially, I didn't realize how much I was just acting's a bit strong, but doing whatever I could to fit in. And I was very fortunate that I was really good at sport. So back in 80s, 90s, 2000s, if you were good at sport, you were popular. I don't know if that's still the case now, but I played team sports. So I was always around people. I could always appear like I had lots of friends and everything was okay. Yeah.
You crafted becoming a chameleon potentially.
Yeah, I think I did. And I was bright, but I was naughty. You know, I was acting out and I was misbehaving.
And am I right in saying you saw your first psychologist when you were 8 and you know, this was because you were having meltdowns and you were being bullied and all these sorts of things. But that counsellor is, you know, there's nothing at that day and age about autism or ADHD. So here we've just got a naughty kid.
Exactly. A kid that's acting out. And yeah, I was smashing things and stealing at school and running away from school. you know, I remember collecting McDonald's free vouchers. There were these little things that you would peel off.
Yes.
And I stored those up. And so I was very calculated, actually. I look back and I'm like, I didn't just, it wasn't a case of like, oh my God, today I'm going to run away. I would plan running away. And I would plan it. I mean, you know, I was talking being like 8, 9 years old, planning to run away. So not particularly well planned, but I had enough.
A plan with stick men and a rope and binoculars.
I had enough nous, I guess, to go, well, food's quite important, isn't it? So
food's quite important. I'm going to peel exactly, these things
so
off.
I'm going to collect these stickers, and then I can, yeah, then I can go and find a McDonald's, and then I'll be able to eat. That'll be okay.
And to be able to
eat. I mean, I only got 1 kilometre down the road and then I got picked up.
I mean, I think the fact that now we've obviously, and we're going to talk about your podcast, which is all about this, but, you know, we're aware 1 in 5 of us is neurodivergent. And, you know, we, for so long, all our past is no understanding, no acknowledgement. And now we recognize, and we're starting to recognize, I suppose, we're not, it's what your podcast is about, we're not there yet, and why it's so, is needed to have a light shone on it, because it is a superpower. You know, when I've spoken to incredible founders on this podcast, everyone knows the last 4 years, highlighting the fact that probably, I mean, I've actually not done the stat yet, which I should probably do before I sort of start waxing lyrical about it. But I don't know, 70% of all guests. I remember talking to Willard Wigan, and he's a micro sculptor. Oh,
I mean, I love that series. I mean, that is my kind of thing.
That thing. He's, as everyone, anyone who hasn't listened to his podcast, he literally sculpts the world's smallest micro art that can fit into the eye of a needle. But that provided refuge for him when he was younger and he was undiagnosed with autism. And he talks all in his podcast anyway about his back garden and his ant hotel that he created with sort of bunk beds for ants.
Love it.
In ant sizes. I mean,
love it.
This stuff. And I want to talk to you more about this, about it. But tell me about then, you leave school. You said you were institutionalized till 18. Now you're coming out of school and you trained to become a chef.
Yeah, I didn't, you know, you get to, I don't know, 16, so I mean, people are always asking you, oh, what do you want, you know, what do you want to be as a grow up, when you grow up as a child? And I kind of got probably to 16, 17, and I didn't really know. And so I think I just followed the path that I saw other people doing, which was you go and do a degree and you go to university and then you go and get a job. And that's what I thought I needed to do. So, you know, I left school and I thought, well, I'm going to take a year out. That year turned into kind of 2 years, but I basically went down to London and I thought, right, I'm going to go and go to cooking school and I'm going to do that for 6 months and I'm going to get some jobs on the side. And so I worked in a pub and I did a bit of the worst job I did, mainly because I was absolutely dreadful at it, was door-to-door selling of British Gas. So I was literally knocking on people's doors and trying to get them to sign up to having their gas and electric provided by British Gas. It was hardcore. I lasted about 3 months. It was all commission-based. I made no money. I was really dreadful at it.
I also think it's quite, you might have been dreadful at it, but I will give you this. I think it's quite a difficult thing.
Yeah,
because, you know,
agree.
I'm there washing up, let's say, in the kitchen, and I'm thinking about, you know, the fact that Harry's shorts don't fit him and whatever. And I'm thinking, and then I answer the door.
Yeah.
Madam, would you like to change your gas provider?
Yeah.
Well, gosh, funny enough, I wasn't thinking about that just then.
I know.
I always do wonder. Now, if someone's selling flowers or something like that, I can always be in the mood for flowers. But gas, It's like, I've got to say, that was quite a difficult job.
Yeah. And I was trying to, I was trying to save up money. I was trying to, I then went and worked as a security guard for Securicore. I mean, the irony, it's not lost on me that two massive organizations, two big corporates like British Gas and Securicore, and me being totally not a corporate person, have never actually worked for in a kind of corporate sense with my career. But, you know, I was sort of being a security guard and I did some landscape gardening. And then I went off and I was like, I'm off. And I went off and I traveled on my own and I went to Thailand.
And this is the moment where I just want you to tell me about this, because
so this is the first experience of Thailand. There were two experiences.
Okay, there were two experiences. Okay,
the first experience was I meant to go for a month, and I was going to travel around, go see the islands, and then I was going to the Philippines, and then I was going to go to Australia, and on this big global tour. And I'd been in Thailand for a few weeks, and I remember sitting on a beach and watching these people breathing fire and doing fire shows. And I love fire. I've loved it since I was a kid. I'm fascinated by it. I think it's amazing.
I bet your parents were so happy about that.
Well, this is in the days where it's internet cafes and you might get the odd email, but ultimately no mobile phones,
Yeah,
you're off.
Fire.
So I was like, I'm going to learn to do that. So I learned fire breathe and I learned how to do the fire shows. And I ended up working at this bar and I would do the fire shows, just me and about three or four other Thai guys. And so I did that. And then I was like, I've got my ticket to the Philippines now. So I flew to Manila. I was there for one day. I was like, I don't fucking like this. I'm going back. So I went back to Thailand. And so and they'd pay me. I was doing the fire shows. That was fine. Then I went to New Zealand. I trained to be a snowboard instructor. I was meant to be there for a couple of months. I ended up being there for 7 or 8 months. I lived in a caravan. I lived in a van that I painted like the A-team van. I mean, it was ridiculous, really. And then I came back to England, and then I went and worked in Botswana for 6 months, and I taught kids in Africa, which was a life-changing, for lots of different reasons, kind of time. So I never did obviously become a chef or do anything immediately with the learning and the techniques, but I knew that I loved food and I knew that I loved plants and flavor. And I knew that I'd go and find stuff out. I'd go and try stuff and I would make stuff happen, or I'd give things a go. And that my appetite for risk was quite high, and that I was quite bold. You know, when I think back to kind of go, all my mates or people that I knew from school were off maybe traveling or doing jobs with other people that they were at school with, or going to university with people they were at school with. And I was off on my own.
And so when you say you went back to Thailand, so there was a... So you're now back home and then you go to Thailand again.
Yeah, I ended up...
And this experience where it was a game of two halves, potentially.
It was. Ultimately, my life went downhill pretty fast. Actually, from, really when I look back, sort of 16, 17, I wasn't particularly happy. And it got to a point where, I ended up in rehab. Probably when I was 23, something like that. And it wasn't the first time that had happened. Yeah, I'd been sectioned. I'd ended up in hospital. I wasn't very well and I wasn't very happy. And one of the things, when you go to rehab for whatever reason, to a place where you can be sort of cut out from the outside world and you can get help for whatever reason, one of the things they kind of try and encourage you or let you know is, guys, this is not really where you come to find a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a partner. This is not what happens here. We're here to focus on ourselves and to get well. I seem to manage to miss that because I found a girlfriend and then decided it'd be a great idea if we moved to India. So we left rehab and moved to India. I mean, ridiculous. Neither of us had ever been to India before. We didn't have jobs. You know, we had backpacks and that was about it. But we were gonna go and live in India for some reason. Anyway, I then found myself a good few months later sitting in an ashram in a place called Rishikesh, which is in the north of India. And that ashram was fairly unique in the sense that it promoted this sort of life or time of silence and very, very simple way of being and routine, eating only rice. And the noise that would come out of your mouth was chanting at mealtimes. And there was something immensely healing about that time and a massive escape from the kind of rest of the world.
What is it about handmade items that just feels so soulful? Is it the fact that they're made to last, I wonder, or is it that you know someone has poured all they've got into creating them? Or maybe it's that you know they are one of a kind, not mass-produced, the finest quality and perfectly imperfect. Because that's our passion at Holly & Co. Our marketplace is a treasure trove of unique finds, shining a light on a collective of brilliant founders, or as we call them, our co's, the talented community, putting the co into Holly & Co. I've brought together a movement of creators who champion quality, sustainability and purpose. A marketplace designed to celebrate craftsmanship, craftswomanship, handmade products and that special touch of magic that only makers bring. Something truly creative and colourful in retail that we've never seen before. There is so much to share, but I'll let you discover it for yourself if you already haven't. Find us at holly.co, the home of small business, where you can vote with your money to help preserve crafts, celebrate originality and help people do what they love. Now, back to our conversation of inspiration. Can I just ask like a little practical question
sure.
on that?
Sure.
Like, you went with your girlfriend.
Yep.
Could you not talk to each other?
We did do a bit of talking to each other.
Whispering.
Yeah, we did. And you can obviously, when you're not making noise, it throws a whole new light on body language and how you communicate and writing or signs or, there's just other, I don't know,
it
does make you think in terms of different ways of communication.
And they say, don't they? Again, Holly Stats not at the forefront here, but I'll just make one up because it's roughly like this, isn't it? It's sort of, is it 70 or 80% of our communication is nonverbal? So quite amazing to actually have that time to really understand. I think it's such an important, such a tangent. It's one of the issues with what I believe is this whole working from home, outside of organisations, people even understanding as a young graduate or whatever, young person coming into the workplace, understanding how to communicate and that it's not 2D and all these things that we, having been brought up in a non-technical sort of advanced era, I do feel it's an amazing skill to understand body language, nuances, understand everything.
It's so underestimated. And I think I'd learned growing up, whether at home or at school, how to read people. And I, on reflection, being autistic, I needed that skill more than anything because it was how I could read a situation, fit in, understand what was happening. And what you can pick up and read without hearing anybody, how that can be really applicable in business.
Oh, completely.
With your team, with customers, etc. I think is really underestimated. That time in India was huge for that actually. And then
you went to Thailand.
Yeah, I knew this island, you know, because I I'd been on one side of it. And it's called Kopan Yang, and I'm sure people have heard of it, been to it. It really is the epitome of a yin and yang island, in that one half is crazy and party and full moon parties and excess and kind of self-obliteration. And then the other half is lots of yoga retreats and spas and very, very different. And I'd spent it on the crazy side.
On the crazy side, yeah.
And so when I went back and I was, 24, I thought, well, I'm going to go to the healing side now, and joined this ashram, this yoga facility. And quite quickly it became apparent that this wasn't just do some yoga and just have a nice time. I got very sucked in. I am incredibly gullible. You tell me something, I believe it. I'm also incredibly trusting. And so I was sucked in. And, I remember we were standing on the full moon party nights. We would go to the beach, the other side of the island, and we would stand in a circle, probably 30 or 40 of us. And we would chant at the moon. And I mean, it sounds ridiculous thinking back, but I became, not brainwashed is a bit strong, but I definitely bought into the only thing you must do in life is yoga. You must not succumb to the West. The West do gymnastics and they don't understand medicine and health, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's okay to have lots of relationships with other people and just really dangerous thoughts and dangerous beliefs.
And luckily, you say it was a cult?
Yeah, it had all the... Yeah, if you look at
DNA of a
exactly,
cult.
Exactly, if you look at the criteria of one.
Yeah.
And I don't
yeah.
think any cult has ever called itself a cult.
Right, yes, of course. Yeah, of course.
No one has said, would you like to
movement,
join my cult?
It's a spirit.
Exactly.
It's a
you
religion.
Feel like,
it's a.
Yeah.
It's the air. You
feel like you're part of a community.
Family.
Exactly. And so I didn't see it for what it was. And eventually I had to come home and sort of face the real world. And sort of snap out of it, And by this time, we'd adopted a cat and we'd adopted a three-legged dog. And we're like, oh, we've got to bring the cat home. So, this little coconut, the cat comes back from Thailand, to be desensitized or, deprogrammed. And then I joined the real world. Was 25 and I got my first, what I would call proper salaried job.
This is a moment where you started working in a design industry and, premium brands such as Nike, Moe and, different companies. I'm just interested, though, that little snapback you're talking about, that sort of cult to design industry, that little journey, was it hellish? I mean, did you know that you had to come back to reality?
Did
you feel better that you were in reality?
I don't know if I necessarily did feel better, because you're on the other side of the world, and I'd escaped ultimately. I'd kind of escaped from the real world, and was I going to live in this cult with my three-legged dog? And I wasn't, not long term. It was painful to kind of come back, and it was a pain.
Did you come back with your girlfriend?
Yeah, I did. And we both had to, come back and face the real world and proper jobs. And I remember kind of going, my God, I'm 25 and I've never had a salaried job. So I'm going to go and get one, and I'm going to start at the bottom. And so I got my first salaried job. I was on £17,000. At a design agency in Marlow, which is where I'd end up moving to then start Seedlip and distilling ingredients.
Yeah. And do you think that's a pullback to, if you think about your dad and design and all those sorts of things, because we talk about this golden thread and sometimes we just find ourselves back in the roots and back where you were this kid, outdoors, you loved experimenting, you were watching your dad do all these things, and here you find yourself in design and industry, and you were experimenting with herbs and distillation in copper pots. So this was the beginning of Seedlip.
I joined this company on 17 grand. 3 years later, I'd been promoted consistently every 3 to 4 months. And, you know, within 3 years, my salary had gone from £17,000 to £70,000. And I was leading.
Wow.
I was leading work and pitches for some of the world's biggest sort of FMCG companies. And it was the first time, really, that I was kind of like, wow, I'm there's something I've got that's good, and I am fascinated by people's behavior and psychology, and I love design, and yeah, I'm kind of fascinated by this, and I'm meeting people who are starting their own businesses. You know, we would work with big clients, big corporate, very slow but huge businesses. And then every now and again, we'd work with founders and we'd work with people who were starting their own thing. And God, they felt like my people. They felt like, wow,
your tribe.
You are like, you've fucking grasped the nettle. Yeah. You are going for it.
Almost like a deconstructed cult.
It was. It was a bit like, you know, like I like what you're saying. I'm going to,
yeah,
I want to.
Yeah,
I
get it. We speak the same language.
Yeah.
Yeah. We believe in the same things.
Yes. And you are these founders. What I loved was they had freedom, and they had freedom to make decisions, make choices, you know, and they would look to us as kind of experts, I guess, in design and brands to help them on that journey. And so that I started feeling the pull. I started feeling the, hey, I've got ideas. I've got, you know, maybe I could, I'd quite like to be what we called client side, not agency side.
Yeah.
And so, but it, you know, I had loads of ideas and I wrote loads of things down, but I'd managed to tell myself that I had loads of ideas, but I would never do anything with them. Like, all I want to do is make the best white shirt in the world. Just that. Just make the most amazing white shirt. Not get carried away doing colours or stripes or anything like that. Just make the best white shirt in the world. Anyway, and then Seedlip was just by accident. Seedlip was, I remember walking into Sainsbury's in Marlow, where I was living. I was living in this little Hansel and Gretel cottage in the woods. And yeah, I was learning to do taxidermy and I was running my own kind of design consultancy. I was quite happy. Yeah, I was sort of quite happy. I was single. I was had my dogs. You know, I was in the woods and I had a big garden there so I could kind of grow lots of different stuff. But I remember walking into the Sainsbury's and looking at that shelf of pots of herbs and just kind of going, why is it always only the same few? Why is it basil that you buy and then it dies, rosemary, dill, you know, why is it this same few? Like, what else is there? And you know, I'd grown up learning about barley and potatoes and turnips and maybe not the most flavorful, tasty kind of things. I'd never come across this world of botanicals and herbs and spices, really. I mean, we were introduced to it a bit at cooking school, but it was far more, they drilled how to cut vegetables properly, how to make a sauce, and seasoning. Like literally those were like the three big lessons I kind of took away. Chop stuff, be able to make sauces and make sure you fucking season and not just at the end. You've got to season all the way through. So this world of suddenly like herbs and spices, I was then like, right, I'm going to get on the internet. Let me see what we've lost. Let me see what else I can get my hands on. Let me grow some stuff. And, you know, Wikipedia is just incredible.
The best.
It's this sort of rabbit warren just opened up of suddenly I found myself going, I need to learn 500 years of botanical history. You know, I need to kind of learn everything. I want to know everything about it. And I want to know every single ingredient. And, you know, we've got 47,000 edible plants in this world now today.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You think how many that we've actually tried or eaten. And so, like, the diversity is sort of off the scale. But I found my way to learning that basically they were making medicine in the 17th century. And that medicine was not pharmaceuticals. It was herbs and spices and plants. And they were using distillation as a way to make that medicine. And some of that medicine was alcoholic and some of that medicine was non-alcoholic. I was just like, oh, I'm seeing these pictures of like these little copper stills and some gadgets and apparatus. Let me get on the internet and I could buy one for 50 quid and I could order some seeds and I could order some plants and I'm just going to have a go. And It was really magical because I was literally taking a plant, changing its whole structure and life. And I was taking this raw material and I was turning it. I was able to actually turn it into a liquid that smelt and tasted like the plant. I thought this was just so incredible and magical that I just wanted to keep doing it. And it was nothing to do with drinks. It was nothing to do with Seedlip. It was fun. And I was hooked and I wanted to keep doing it and keep trying more things.
And so what was the spark that made you think, hang on a second, there is a pretty big gap in the market? I read that you called, am I right in saying this, a ton of places pretending you had a friend who was pregnant and saying, what do you have that's non-alcoholic?
Yeah,
the cheapest. People would either not answer you or say orange juice.
Yeah, as this journey moved from like, a bit of fun to then, oh my God, non-alcoholic spirits, I'm going to create one. And what do you drink when you're not drinking alcohol? And wow, I'm going to take this to a farmer's market, or I'm going to do it part-time, or I'm going to have my own brand. And that morphing all the way to kind of, oh my God, Selfridges like it. And the Fat Duck likes it. And oh wow, I'm going to double my first production run to 1,000 bottles. I didn't have lots of money. So I was like, I wonder, I can't go and visit all the best bars, restaurants, hotels, you know. So what's an easy, quick way of finding out what they have on their menu or even where they're at? What do they think about
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, take 500 of the best accounts in the UK, tell them you want to come for a birthday drink and your friend's pregnant, see what they say. And so many people, you know, didn't have anything on their menu. So many people said, oh, maybe we can make you something on the day, which didn't feel particularly considered, actually. Yeah. And then other people just told me that they had, I could have a kind of blend of fruit juices, or there was Coca-Cola and lemonade and elderflower cordial. And that was just like, that told me so much. That gave me such a good insight into, yeah, the fact there was just nothing out there that was talking to people who were looking for something that was grown up, sophisticated, adult, that just didn't contain alcohol.
I mean, lots of people would say, so then that was either it's a moment, isn't it, that someone hears the answers and says, God, no one wants this. There isn't, like, you yep. basically go, the doors are closed, so everyone's just orange juice, and your brain is not wired to then looking at that as the opportunity. That's more the doors are closing straight in my face. I need to now think of this distillation I'm doing and do something else with it. Or you say, my goodness me, I have just found the fact that nobody is doing it. And now, you know, there wasn't a place for your product to sit in at all. It just simply didn't exist. Am I right in saying it's like 2013, 14 here?
Yeah, we launched, 2015.
So yeah, so this is only a decade ago.
There was Beck's Blue.
And now this category is worth over 13 billion. And it's one of those things, isn't it, that it is just that way that you look at it. Is it doors closing or doors opening? And for you, it was doors opening. And of course it was, because now if we look back in hindsight and we think about how we are more and more consciously consuming, we're understanding what we're putting into it. You know, there's such a movement, isn't there?
Yep.
If you think about people listening, because maybe they've had ideas, they've done something like yourself, and the doors for them closed because that was not seeing the opportunity. What do you think it takes? Is it bravery? Madness?
I think it's a combination of, yeah, you know, don't get me wrong, I wanted to close the business every day for 6 months when we launched. And that was against the backdrop of being invited to Buckingham Palace, selling out, hearing from 100 countries in the first 3 months, getting listed in, you know, Selfridges and all these amazing places, loads of press, lots of, you know, the most dream start you could imagine. And I hated it. And I've since learned that's because that was not my plan. That's not how I planned it to go. That wasn't my forecast. That wasn't my budget.
And we talked about this when we met each other.
You know?
Because do not divert you off your plan.
Exactly.
Because then that makes you not necessarily, yeah, feel calm.
No, and my plan was incredibly conservative and incredibly slow. You know, that's how I want. But what would I say to people out there? I think it's a couple of things. One, just because somebody thinks it's a bad idea doesn't mean it's a bad idea. So I had lots of people tell me that Seedlip would never sell a bottle, but I held on to, regardless of, it wasn't about holding on to non-alcoholic spirits. It wasn't about holding on to Seedlip. It was about holding on to the bigger forces at work that told me that there could be an opportunity for a grown-up, sophisticated option if you're not drinking alcohol. That could have been anything. It was Seedlip in my world, but that could have been anything as the solution. And so I that's what I tried to stay fixed to, even though there were lots of haters, lots of naysayers, lots of people that, you know, told me, what's the point? And this is, you know, this is a terrible idea. Kind of don't do it. I guess I stayed true to, well, I've spoken to the 500 accounts. I've got that kind of grounding to kind of understand the lay of the land, as it were.
And it's also, you know, all ideas come from really the founder being grounded in knowing that there is truth in their dream. I think that, you know, it's whether that other people don't agree with it, as you said, naysayers or all those, but you've got to have truth in your dream, as in you've gone and validated it yourself. It's not something that you are, you know, so many people think entrepreneurs are so risky. Actually, I really don't think we are. We like risk, but we like calculated risk.
Yep.
And so actually knowing in your heart of hearts that actually no one understood that they needed this, but as the world is turning and you have people that don't drink alcohol, there must be many more people like yourself that don't drink alcohol. So what are they drinking? And this is a universal issue. You know, it could be anything like that. I think about Holly & Co. and I think about, you know, how we are more and more becoming, again, conscious in what we're buying. And actually, we don't want to have to compromise our style, design, taste, fun for things to be good for the planet or to be supporting our values.
Yep.
And so if you know that to be true and you've done the research and you've got that grounding as a founder, that's when it's calculated risk to put your foot on the accelerator and go for it, regardless. And I think that that is something that is a beautiful thing. I do feel it's quite a spiritual thing in a way, because you can't give people reams of data, and you can't give, I mean, maybe you, but you know it to be true. You know the naysayers are wrong. It feels like they're right sometimes.
Yep.
As well. Because,
yep,
you know, it's all playing to them.
Seedlip's worst. Seedlip season, Hinton, anything that I'm doing, I guarantee I've thought more worse things about it than anyone could
ever say. Absolutely. Agree.
And that's so helpful.
And it's so helpful. You are absolutely pulling it apart day in, day out. To the world, it doesn't look like this at all, but you're practically, you're at the divorce papers. You are now about to go. It's just, but it is such a tonic for the company. Tell me about designing a premium brand, because Seedlip is beautiful. Curved bottles with the farm animals on the label, heritage, authenticity. Visually, it's different on a bar, on a table. Obviously, you knew how to do that. Did you ever think you would be designing a premium brand for you?
Seedlip, I wasn't creating a drink for me. It was a project for me, and it was a outlet. And same with Season. You know, I'm the worst like frontman.
We're going to talk about Season in a minute.
I'm the worst frontman for a drinks business because I don't really consume my own products. Not because I don't like them, because I really only drink three drinks: smoothie, coffee, and water. That's it. So I don't have a big. The repertoire that people have, I remember doing a project with Dow Egberts, a coffee brand, and they'd done a whole load of research to say that really we only have about six drinks in our repertoire as human beings, which actually kind of makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like water, tea, coffee, there's three. But we are creatures of habit. So we all kind of drink what we know and drink what we drink. With Seedlip and Season, it's all just me expressing myself, but doing, and that's what, you know, and seeing a project through, which is what feeds me, is kind of having an idea, the process of putting it together, getting to work with nature and taste and all that kind of stuff, you know, brands, design, packaging, business model, the finance side, the legal, so all that I love. And it's not that I'm not interested when it launches, but I'm not as interested, I'll be honest. I'm not.
Yeah.
That is my contribution. And so the only thing I need to make sure is that, A, is it commercially viable? Do I make it for less money than I sell it, right? Just like really simple.
Yeah.
Can it scale? Number two, does it meet a need or have a place in the world? And number three, does it align, I guess, with how I see the world? And what I care about, what I think is important. And so, yes, Seedlip was about, I don't know, it was probably more to me about telling a story and having a say of like,
yeah,
if you're not drinking alcohol, I don't care why you're not drinking alcohol, but I just care you get a great drink, don't you?
Dell Technologies are passionate champions of small businesses. They recognise that it can be a lonely road, and so they have the Dell Women Entrepreneurs Network, or DWEN for short, which is a worldwide community of over 100,000 female founders. They run free events and mentoring programmes and have a network of brilliant women all connecting and sharing insight. They also recognise that for many small businesses, visibility is one of the biggest challenges they face when trying to reach new customers. So each week, Dell give away their ad break space. So now I'm going to hand over to this week's winner of Dell's independent ad break.
As a small business owner, you know that PR is such an important tool for increasing awareness and driving sales, especially when it comes to launches. It can also be really expensive. And if you've worked with agencies in the past, you might just get the feeling that smaller clients or budgets tend to be given to more junior team members to manage, or they can be shunted to the bottom of the pile of priorities. The Press Office works with small businesses to teach them how to manage their own PR strategy in-house, with monthly membership programs, courses, and timely content, along with live Q&A sessions and community groups. We work together to build your bespoke campaigns and develop your skills so that you can maintain control of your brand and your contacts whilst keeping your budget in check. Visit thepressofficegroup.com for more details.
Thank you, Dell, for your support and generosity. If you'd like to find out more about DWEN and connect with brilliant and inspiring women, or you'd like to be in with a chance to have your very own ad break here on this series, head to holly.co/Dell. Now, back to this week's conversation of inspiration. You also have said that ADHD and autism have been your friends on this journey. I read that you described your ADHD as an accelerator in your life and that autism is your brake, which I just think I've just never heard that at all. And you've now obviously got your podcast, The Hidden 20%, you know, educating others, the 80%, to basically celebrate different types of minds. Can you tell me why it's become quite an important part of your story, your world, rather than something that you sit with? You've brought it to the forefront, like one of your businesses that you create. Why have you done that?
Because I like to make things better and I like to create. And I, you know, I guess with drinks, I see this great opportunity to change some of the stigma or the taboo or the just beliefs and perceptions around what makes a great drink. I'm also, when I was diagnosed autistic in September 2022, so not very long ago, and my view on autism, if you'd asked me, if we'd been having this conversation, you asked me, what did I think about autism? I would say, well, it's probably someone like the Rain Man. And maybe really good at maths and really socially awkward, and that's probably about it. And if you'd asked me, can girls be autistic? I probably would have said no. No, I think it's a kind of male thing. And if you'd asked me, you know, could I see myself as being autistic? I would have laughed because I had very, really blinkered beliefs. And I'd never heard the word neurodiversity before. And so being diagnosed and literally the psychologist saying, congratulations, Ben, you're autistic. I felt and believe, I mean, I take things literally. So I did generally believe her, but I also think she was telling the truth. It was this amazing, just an amazing moment to be given this opportunity to learn more about how I work and how my brain works and why the amazing things that my brain can do and the challenging things that my brain finds have an explanation for those. But also, as someone who I like love to learn, what an amazing opportunity to be given to learn about neurodivergence, about autism, about ADHD, dyslexia, you know, the whole kind of gamut. And then, based on what I learned, which in really simple terms was two things. Number one, even now in 2024, society has a very warped and outdated view of neurodivergence. And number two, all of my heroes, all of the people who I think have significantly contributed to our daily lives, the culture and fabric of our society in a positive way, we're all neurodivergent. So how are we in this situation in 2024 where 85% of children that are diagnosed dyslexic are ashamed of it? Mm. How are up to 80% of people in our prison system misdiagnosed, undiagnosed, or not supported? How are people waiting 10 years for a diagnosis because of an NHS system and infrastructure that can't handle them? And how are less than 40% of neurodivergent adults in full-time employment? Like, I could not compute the two things. So I guess I set out on a mission to try and close the gap and catch society up in the same way that I'd caught up myself, I guess, and just shift the narrative.
I want to ask you two things. When to get to this point, tell me and those listening what was happening with Seedlip, why you were able to spend that time on this charity.
Yeah, so you know, Seedlip went my kitchen table and only me. In fact, I was the fourth employee because I didn't employ myself to begin with, but me in my kitchen to 35 countries, three offices in three continents, 80 people, grown faster than Fevertree, Innocent, Brewdog, anybody, Hendrix, any drinks business you want to throw in the mix, we were growing faster than it, to a majority acquisition to Diageo, so world's biggest premium spirits company, buying a non-alcoholic spirit. What the fuck?
Incredible.
In the summer of 2019. And typically the average for a drinks exit in the world of alcohol, non-alcohol, is 7 years. So wild, absolutely wild, life-changing, all the rest of it. And so I'm still a shareholder now. So still being the founder, still getting involved, new products, what initiatives are coming up next, gently and politely trying to tap Diageo and, you know, nicely beat them with a stick sometimes.
Herd them.
Exactly. Yeah. A bit of trying to do a bit of herding. And then by this time, I sort of, I'm not done. That's not enough.
Yeah.
I've got more in the locker. So I'd started working on an idea called Season to try and, I couldn't believe two things. One, we are drilled into, I'd been drilled in anyway, season, your food. But we didn't, and I know how much that makes a difference. And, you know, Gordon Ramsay will swear at you if you're not seasoned your food. And we're conditioned into seasoning makes things tastier with our food, but not with our drinks. I kind of hadn't seen that behavior applied to drinks. So that was one interesting thought bubble that was sort of marinating. And then the second was that Angostura has 92% market share. Angostura, yes, cocktail bitters,
I mean,
been around for 200 years. And that's one of those shut doors where you can look at that and go,
correct.
Yeah, but they own 92%. They're in 190 countries. What point? Why? Let them have it. Let them keep going. Whereas I see, it speaks to my sense of moral justice of like, that's just not fair. They are not allowed. And so then you can do some quick checks, and you know, Instagram can be really helpful. So I went and I added up. I looked at the four biggest cocktail bitters brands in the world. The second and third ones aren't even on social media and don't have a website. So I was like, okay, that's kind of interesting. The fourth one has a portfolio of 130 products. And I was like, wow, that seems so unwieldy. And then I was like, well, the top 10 cocktail bitters brands on social media have less following combined than Seedlip. Something's not computing here. It's kind of stayed as this bartender's thing, bartender's secret. What if we could flip that and take that to the consumer and kind of go, look, really easy, a few dashes and this will make your drinks really tasty. It's like a hack. We love a hack.
We do.
Kitchen hack.
Gosh, we are.
And so,
I mean,
a few dashes.
Hack is just going to become a word, isn't it? And, you know, when they introduce new language in our kids, it's going to be all about the hack.
All about the hack. Yeah, and a hack when I was growing up was, that's what you do with the horses.
Correct. Absolutely. That was it. Now it's just a very different thing.
Yeah. So anyway, we're just trying to, we're only a few months old, Holly, but
it's fascinating.
I've set off your
brain. Oh,
yeah, some hairs in motion. And yeah, we launched this week in the US, which you don't do as a drinks brand when you're a few months old. But we've had, it's the biggest cocktail bits market in the world. They make cocktails at home over there we're mega excited. And it's got into, yeah, seasons in all the nice posh Michelin star, like chefs love it.
You're doing it again.
Excited about it.
You're doing it
doing
again.
It again.
I mean, God, your brain is just, and the other question I wanted to ask you is, when you got your diagnosis, were you relieved? Did things start to make sense? You know, I go back to, yeah, mum sent me to work with dad because I got suspended a few times. And, you know, that was right at the beginning of this story. and we come to the end of the story and to the point it is today. And I'm wondering if you just think, my God, I always struggled with these things.
I tell you, Holly, I am. It sounds. I'm so amazed by this, shocked by this, that to even say the kind of words out loud of, like, I'm more myself than I've ever been. And no one should have to say that, right? No one should have to have that delineation of, well, that's a big word.
It is.
You know, it's a big word, isn't it? I hate long words. So that's unusual. But no one, there shouldn't be this sort of separation of suddenly it being okay to be yourself. But I am. I've dropped the mask, and I am more kinder to myself than I've ever been. I am loving, for good and for bad, my brain more than ever. And I feel like I'm in partnership with it rather than in kind of conflict with it. And that's huge. I just feel like I've just sort of got a new pair of glasses, and they're, you know, I haven't had my eyes tested for a while. You get that new pair and you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay, now it is just crystal. Okay.
How empowering. And how empowering, because there you are starting your new business. And from hearing you speak, it's not going to be, this is not it yet. So your brain will just keep doing this thing. And the clearer your glasses are and the vision that you have, we as consumers get to have the benefit of that magic that's coming out. And far from being the kids in the playground that would, you know, bully you for that, you know, we're going to applaud you for that. And it's just a really beautiful story. One of the things I wanted to say before we come to the end is, do you now, when you look, what does your family now feel and the people around you? You know, they've obviously had to go on pretty hectic journey with you. You know, if I think about coming back from that cult, I really doubt those around you thought, you know what's going to happen? He's going to create one of the most talked about brands. And like, that is definitely, I do not think they were writing in their journals, their daily journals, you know, I've just got a funny feeling. And everything from the past, I'm wondering how people are seeing this Ben that is more content than ever, and the past versus sort of your future.
My mother just, I think probably since I was about 20, actually, she's just said, you know, nothing surprises me about you, Ben, you know, which she just sort of, I don't know, it feels like she just takes everything on the chin. I think my family think that I'm absolutely crackers, right? I'm kind of, yeah, you know, my youngest brother said to me the other day, it's like, so let me get this straight. You're living between two houses because you're selling one, you bought another one. You've got three kids, you've got three dogs. There's 30 sheep and two alpacas out there. You've just got some pigs. You've got one chicken. You've got 14 fish in one place and five fish in another place. You've launched a charity. You've launched Season. You're building a laboratory, as you can see behind
me,
for another project. And you've got a third project also that you're also kind of commercializing. What the fuck?
And you're like, yeah.
But do you know what? Do you know what? The only...
Do you feel overwhelmed by that?
No, I feel on the edge.
Most
of
you.
I feel on the edge, but in a good way. I'm kind of terrified, but I'm excited. You know, I've got the most wonderful wife, which is just amazing. And my kids are brilliant. And then the key is I feel like I work with incredible people. So I'm not leading all these things, right? I am leading them to a point, but then I'm getting out of the way and then letting other people who are brilliant lead them. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, otherwise it's my own selfish way of like, if I really want this to happen, if I really want to build a lab to make this incredible drink that we're going to make, that's been in my head for like 12 years, it's not going to, I'm never going to build the lab if it's just me. I'm never going to get around to it. It'll never happen. So guess what? Get out of the way. find someone who's amazing, as we found, Jack, and then it's got way more chance of happening. And so I'm not precious. Yeah. That's one thing I've really learned, is to not cling on. It's like touching, but not, no clinging on, and to get the fuck out of the way. Otherwise, I'll let it down.
Such good advice. Yeah, otherwise you let it down. And that's by knowing yourself, right? I just love this conversation. Adore you, as you know, firmly adore you. When you and I were trying to work out how we tap phones and send our contacts through WhatsApp, and then everyone around us was like, uh-oh, those two are not going to be able to stop until they've worked it out. And they just sort of stood there going crazy brains together.
Nobody wanted to step in, did they? Go,
no,
guys.
I know, but they sort of knew, because we wouldn't be accepting the fact we had to know. Tell me, I use the analogy about the roller coaster and this being just the most outrageous ride of your life. Tell me about your greatest low, or what you would class as your greatest low.
Oh, I used to do these ridiculous trips with Seedlip whereby I didn't want to be away from home for longer than I needed to be. And so I would put myself through, just a trip like this where, you know, I go London, Amsterdam, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Melbourne, Sydney, Auckland, Auckland, LA, New York, New York, Toronto, back to London. And I'd do that in 2 weeks. And I would be jam-packed. And I'd cry when I got on the plane. I'd cry when I got on the plane home. But I would just, instead of that being a four-week trip, it would be a two-week trip. Yeah. And so I'd pack it in. And I remember being in Singapore. I was on a conference call with the Seedlip board. And I was being pushed kind of through security. And so I needed actually to kind of put the phone on the scanner and then pick it back up. And we just learned that we had £1 million working capital hole. And yeah, that we were going to run out of money. And I was in tears, knackered in tears. I'd just come straight from an event to the airport. Then got this board call. You've got to join this call, Ben. Ah, but I've got to get on a plane. No, you've got to join it. We've just found £1 million hole in the business. And just kind of going, I don't even know what time it is in the UK, crying. I've got to get on this flight. I'm being pushed through security. It was horrendous. And then just to sit on this flight with kind of no real communication with what was going
on. That news and no communication.
Anyway, we sorted it out. But... that was a real low.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, so that was brutal.
Did you find $1 million behind the sofa? That would have been good. And tell me about your greatest high.
Whenever I go into a bar or a restaurant or went to my local farm shop here just near Colchester, first time, went there. River, our little four-year-old comes running over and daddy, they've got your bottle, you know, and that's any place where you see the bottles or, you know, someone's like, hey, they've got a bottles of season at their HQ and they're another drinks company. You get a bit of a pep. I think that the biggest high was when we'd done the deal with Diageo. I then went on paternity leave. Literally, Sam gave birth 10 days after we did that deal, and I went on paternity leave. But we organized for the global Seedlip team, to all come together and all go up to my farm in Lincolnshire and all spend a couple of days together to celebrate. And, you know, I'd given 20% of the business to my team. So everybody, whether you joined 3 months before acquisition or your employee number one, you got shares in the business. And getting everybody together, yeah, that was really special. That was a really special moment.
I can imagine. Life-changing for people. I can just imagine. Amazing.
Yeah, really cool.
Oh, gosh. You are, I like you so much. Tell me, Ben, can you do us the honour of reading a letter to your younger self? I don't know what age you might have picked.
I haven't really picked an age, and I do need to give some caveat, a bit of context here, Holly, in that as someone who loves optimization and efficiency and nonfiction and is very literal, and I found this a total waste of time.
Yeah.
So I could not, which actually, I mean, I'll just read the letter. But I was politely hating on you a little bit of like.
Yeah, I listen, you along with 200 other people. I mean, really, just along with the chickens and the alpacas and the things and the five businesses and the million billion things to do. Let me just write a wasteful letter for you.
Okay, here goes. Hi Ben, it's Ben. Holly asked me to write you a letter. She's wonderful, but this, in my brain, is a pointless exercise and waste of time. So let me get to the point and be blunt. People will hurt you, take advantage of you, abandon you, but ultimately you will hurt you. You will do everything in your power to destroy yourself. You will feel worthless, ashamed, guilty, angry, hopeless, scared, and broken. You will have absolutely nothing, but not forever. You will keep going. You'll become the sum of the horror and be grateful for it. Your dream and your wildest dreams will come true. You will love so much sometimes it hurts, and it will all be worth it. Say hi to George. His back legs will go when he's 15. Ben. George is my Dalmatian.
You are a very unique human being. I'm sure many people have told you that. You know, and I say this, you know, everyone listening right now, we now know you and we know who you are. And it is safe to say you are highly, highly unique. And gosh, we're so lucky that we get to be on this part of your path, like the island, two sides. I feel like we're on the other side now of Ben, and we're going to be watching with our pom-poms and our cheerleading outfits on the sidelines, just waiting to see what's going to happen. And just thank you for your time.
I'm literally just getting started, Holly.
I can tell.
I actually want
the world to watch out slightly, because I'm reckoning you're just sort of, each business is just going to gear up to another issue that you're going to solve, and the way your brain works. I just can't thank you enough for your time today. You've just inspired us. You're a brilliant storyteller, and thank you so much for putting yourself through that agony of the letter. If I was there, I'd give you a massive hug to say thank
you're
you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Holly.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.